the president of the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation and member of the American Academy and the American Philosophical Society, Don Michael Randall.
Thank you. That the nation's ancient learned societies should meet in the nation's capital to talk about the public good and democratic society is altogether a good thing at this moment in the nation's history. While there's much to celebrate, our democracy needs continuing attention, and we might well take the view that it needs more attention now than it has in some time. I could easily point with pride and view with alarm long enough to provide a decent interval until the food and wine are served. And I could try to lift the spirits of us all by playing short variations on the unmistakably positive references of the three principal terms in our gathering, 4 minutes each on the public good, knowledge, and democratic society, beginning with excerpts from the OED on each term, and concluding with a rousing call to action by us all. You've all heard such speeches. I do wish to talk about our title, and I do wish to applaud its positive resonances. After all, who could possibly be opposed in principle to the public good, knowledge, or a democratic society? But I also want to suggest some ways in which these terms, as we have assembled them, are incomplete and themselves require a somewhat deeper foundation worthy of serious discussion. A professor of philosophy in my undergraduate years once said that in answering an examination question on topic X, it was never wrong to begin by saying, "That depends on what you mean by X." Let's start with knowledge. Well, it does depend on what you mean by knowledge. Even without plunging into a deep discussion of epistemology or post-epistemological views of what it might mean, it is clear enough that in this room, we would almost certainly wish to question the role in a democratic society of what a good many people would insist on calling knowledge. What, for example, about divine revelation? Our democracy protects the right of people to believe in divine revelation and to regard that revelation as knowledge. But some of the most contentious issues before this country today are rooted in clashes over whether what some regard as divinely revealed knowledge can be the foundation for laws that must be obeyed by everyone in a democracy. And no one viewing the history of Christianity should feel entitled to single out Islam or any other religion for criticism in this context. Perhaps what we mean by knowledge as a foundation for a democratic society is instead the product of something like the scientific method, the set of propositions that we regard as accurately describing the world outside of ourselves, the, quote, real world, in short. Here again, let us avoid the deeper discussion of philosophy that might wish to explode this whole notion and settle for common sense. We probably mean something more like the phrase used by our very own American Philosophical Society, namely useful knowledge. This would mean the set of propositions that work for going about the world, making things, causing certain things to happen. This then raises the question, useful for what purposes? Today, and perhaps even in Benjamin Franklin's day, the answer to this question is most likely in one way or another to be to keep the American economy stronger than any other. A close corollary is to keep the national defense strong, so as to keep our democracy strong, so as to keep our economy strong. On seeing the title of the present gathering, many of us will have thought instantly of the report recently published by the National Academies under the title, Rising Above the Gathering Storm, Energizing and Employing America for a Brighter Economic Future. It argues powerfully for increased investments in education and research, in science and technology, a cause in which many of us have been engaged for some time. The executive summary begins as follows. The United States takes deserved pride in the vitality of its economy, which forms the foundation of our high quality of life, our national security, and our hope that our children and grandchildren will inherit ever greater opportunities. That vitality is derived in large part from the productivity of well-trained people and the steady stream of scientific and technical innovations they produce, Without high-quality, knowledge-intensive jobs and the innovative enterprises that lead to discovery and new technology, our economy will suffer and our people will face a lower standard of living. Economic strength, which is to say global competitiveness, and national security are the twin motives for enhancing the production of knowledge. And this will enable us to remain free and democratic. Medical knowledge, which is not entirely unrelated to economic strength and competitiveness, is the only other kind of useful knowledge that has anything like so strong a claim on the national attention. If you doubt that these are the principal motives for the production of knowledge, or at least the motives most likely to gain traction in this country, consider some of the kinds of useful knowledge in which we do not invest. Everyone knows that the design of acoustically superior concert halls is far from being an established science. I have long feared that this is principally because the design of acoustically superior concert halls has never been seen as essential to the national defense. I would welcome your suggestions for ways in which we might relate concert halls to the national defense so as to be able to take this case to the American people. This instrumental view of knowledge is surely not sufficient, however, at least not for the members of our two societies. And we ought to want to make that clear. Even if we were content with this as our operating definition, it would be insufficient as the foundation of a democratic society. This has to do with our beliefs about the uses to which any kind of useful knowledge can be put. The production of useful knowledge reached extraordinary heights in Germany in the second quarter of the 20th century, in the Soviet Union in the third, and of course in neither case did it provide a sufficient foundation for a democratic society. In short, useful knowledge can be employed in the commission of the most heinous crimes and in the maintenance of the most repressive governments. There are some kinds of knowledge that we believe should not even be accumulated in the first place because they're not anybody else's business. The right to privacy is fundamental, and yet the invasion of that privacy is sometimes thought to be justified on the grounds of the protection of our democratic society, as we know only too well these days. Another implication of the term knowledge in relation to the foundation of democratic society deserves to be mentioned as well, especially but not only in this town. This is the implication that knowledge and truth are somehow linked. The easy part of this is that one should not lie. That is, it cannot be knowledge, in at least the instrumental sense, if it isn't true and subject to some reasonable verification. Democracy fails if the citizenry is not told the truth. We have too many cases readily at hand in which the citizenry has been quite simply lied to and in which powerful pressure has been placed on scientists to dilute or suppress altogether their findings in relation to public policy. We must insist in a democratic society on living by prodigious honesties, in the words of Richard Wilbur. Now we come closer to what is missing when we say that knowledge is the foundation of a democratic society. This narrow instrumental view of knowledge, which often dominates our thinking, needs at a minimum to be expanded by or supported by ideas and values, about which we may also reason and which may even be thought useful, but which are ultimately taken as axiomatic. Ultimately, the foundation of a democratic society is a shared commitment to a democratic society and all that it entails about the rights and duties of individuals. This commitment to the rights of individuals, to take what might be the crucial foundation of a democratic society, arises not, in my view, out of the application of instrumental reason to the production of knowledge. It is more nearly a matter of faith or belief, often in the face of cruel reality. It is ultimately of a piece with love, the manifest power of which in human life I would decline to attribute to its mere usefulness. This notion of commitment, of course, leads us to the matter of the common good and its relationship to a democratic society. Unfortunately, that relationship is not unproblematic. To the extent that democracy values and indeed celebrates the rights of individuals to their own difference, It makes more difficult widespread agreement about the commitment to any particular definition of the common good, at least any definition of the common good that would be the basis for collective action. This difficulty is very much before us today, and Tocqueville warned of it long ago. The citizenry lapses into a complacency about the collectivity on the one hand, and a preoccupation with individually defined spheres of identity on the other. Low voter turnout is evidence of the former. The inability of public institutions to take forceful action on pressing social problems is often evidence of the latter. In the face of this, a strong economy and the national defense are simply the lowest common denominators to which a broad appeal can be made. Never mind, of course, that there are a great many devils in the details, even here. The danger for people like ourselves, let's say people who care about the life of the mind, is that in making the argument for knowledge as the foundation of a democratic society in instrumental terms, we adopt the modes of thought of the, as it were, enemy. Of course, a strong economy is a good thing, if we can figure out how to distribute the wealth humanely. And of course, a strong national defense is essential, if we can figure out who our enemies really are and how to deal with them by means that need not always include the force of arms. But we ought to produce knowledge in our society simply because, as human beings, we cannot help it. The ultimate foundation of any society ought to be the human imagination, honed to the greatest degree along with her faithful companion, curiosity. There's no doubt that our failure to maintain the national investment in the physical sciences has been myopic in the extreme for all kinds of very practical reasons. But every bit as tragic has been to hear people in high places sometimes contemplate the possibility, for example, of merely ceding US leadership in high energy physics to the Europeans. This is as contrary to the spirit of this nation and to the foundation of its democracy as anything could possibly be. We ought to want to build the International Linear Collider in this country simply because we're desperate to know what it would enable us to learn. Job creation in Illinois and elsewhere should be strictly secondary. Let us all remember Robert Wilson's remarks to Congress when asked about the contribution of the Fermilab accelerator to the national defense. He said it would be among the things that made the country worth defending. I believe that if we were, in fact, the most imaginative nation on the face of the globe, much else that we worry about today would be far along the way towards solution. What to do about this? By all means, let us strengthen the teaching of and the research in science and mathematics at all levels. But the study of what makes these undertakings truly worthwhile, the study of the values that support the production of knowledge and its proper application in society, the study of, the contemplation of, the exploration of what it means to be a human being, and why and how we should want to organize our lives in relation to one another around the globe, these are the domains of the humanities and the arts. And talk about underinvestment. This is not even principally about money, since the amounts in question are so utterly pathetic. The National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Endowment for the Arts will together make grants of just over $200 million this year. There are defense contractors who have grave difficulty keeping track of amounts so small. We should, of course, spend more at the national level, but also locally in K through 12 education, where the decline in arts programs has been precipitous. But above all, we need simply to talk and act as if we truly believe that the humanities and the arts matter and underlie the deepest foundations of a democratic society. Thinking about such things doesn't really cost much money. It requires simply making the space for them in our national life and trying to live by what we find there, no matter the method or the size of our contribution to the gross domestic product. Some of my friends will tire of hearing me quoting William Carlos Williams, but I will do it anyway. He writes in one of his longer poems, "It is difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there." Later in the same poem, He continues, "Only the imagination is real. I've declared it time without end. If a man die, it is because death has first possessed his imagination. But if he refuse death, no greater evil can befall him unless it be the death of love meet him in full career. Then indeed for him the light has gone out. But love and the imagination are of a piece, swift as the light to avoid destruction. Let us strive to find the common good among our differences. Let us lay and maintain the foundation of a democratic society. Let knowledge grow. But may knowledge be amply and generously imagined, useful at times to be sure, but grounded always in a compassionate and restless human spirit." Thank you.